The Institute on Religious Life presents these lectures on Catholic doctrine by Father John A. Hardin of the Society of Jesus to give impetus to the new evangelization called for by Pope John Paul II. This series on Understanding the Bible, Part 5, was given during the fall semester 1993 at Domino's Farms, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I thought I would have one class during the month of November on, the poor souls, purgatory. Even though our concentration is on the scriptures, I would like to talk about this subject, which is in sacred scriptures. It is part of our revealed faith. Today's gospel was, as you know, totally in character with the month, which is specially dedicated to the poor souls. It goes back to apostolic times, and November, being the last month of the ecclesiastical year, liturgically, as you know, the Catholic Church thinks in terms of what we call the liturgy, where the month of December, give or take a few days, is the period of immediate preparation for Christ's coming. The ecclesiastical year, therefore, begins on the first Sunday of Advent and ends in the last week of the last week before Advent. In other words, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end to everything in this life. As you mentioned, the Church's tradition has identified the last month of the ecclesiastical year by dedicating it to the souls of those who had died in God's friendship but are not yet in heavenly glory. And then before Advent, because even though during the season of Advent, we do commemorate Christ's advent or coming in visible form at the Incarnation. Yet, Christ will come again, and indeed he will come again. And the most important advent in our lives is our life here on earth, preparing for the second coming in theological language when he calls us out of what we call the valley of tears into eternity. He calls us then into eternity, and as we know further, there will be, let's call it, a third advent at the end of the world, and all will be judged, both those who have lived good lives to be judged and rewarded, and those who have died as estranged from God, judged and punished accordingly. One of my favorite definitions, I might say, for life on earth, our life on earth is a prolonged advent. Now, what is the importance not of course of just the month of November, but of devoting, as a church does, one whole month to commemorating the souls of the faithfully departed. It is, first of all, a memory of these who had lived and may have been, as I know I'm sure there are loved ones in all of our lives. I doubt if there's a single exception for a loved one who is not already, that being you, who has entered eternity. And of course, the longer you stay on earth, the more the number of those gone before you into eternity will increase. But there's a special importance in spending a whole month in commemorating the faithful departed, not only in praying for them, but in identifying with the poor souls, because they have earned their eternal salvation. In other words, one thing we should remember is the poor souls are poor in one sense, because they have not yet reached heavenly glory, but they are profoundly rich in another sense, because they have deserved to enter their heavenly destiny. There are then three parts to this, call it class lecture. The who, the how, and then the implications. So who are the poor souls? How can we help the poor souls? And then lessons for our spiritual life. Who are the poor souls? The poor souls are of those human beings who died in the friendship of God. And by friendship of God, we mean in the possession of sanctifying grace, or from another perspective, in the possession of the indwelling Trinity. And in today's world, there is, I hope you agree, a widespread confusion, ambiguity, uncertainty. And this is among believing Catholics. In so many churches now, you just do not offer Mass for, say, a person who has died for the repose of that person or person's soul or souls. I've offered Mass in many places, both in this country and elsewhere, where there are only white vestments. People tell me, attending funerals now, you just assumed, I am told, well, they're going to heaven. And I think I should repeat my dear missionaries of charity, the list of, well, our fellow sisters waiting for us in heaven. Well, I tell them I admire your faith. I'm so happy that you are confident that your fellow sisters are already waiting for you in heaven. I must say that we Jesuits are not so sure about our brethren.
Father, does that reflect on the Jesuits?
I just made a simple declarative sentence. Behind our faith in the souls in purgatory is that every sin, and the word is every sin, carries with it two inevitable consequences. Two. Always. The first consequence is the loss of grace. And the second consequence is the incurring of a debt of pain. No one ever sins can be a trifling peccadillo or can be a grave crime. No one ever sins without losing grace. No one ever sins without incurring a debt of pain. Once you say that, then we don't have to look at other people. We just have to look at our own souls. We've all sinned. And having sinned, we've lost grace, and we've incurred a debt of suffering. And consequently, in teaching, especially in Protestant seminaries, and they were paying the Jesuits good money for me to teach Catholicism in a Protestant seminary. It just makes sense that having sinned, even though, as we believe, when we die, there is the restoration of grace or the remission of guilt, but it is infallible teaching in Catholic Christianity that the debt of suffering or of pain is normally not remitted, say, by the sacrament of confession. And one reason, for example, for assisting at Mass as often as possible, receiving Holy Communion, even when possible twice a day, performing acts of piety, prayers that gain indulgence. Behind all of that is the Church's belief that having sinned, we still have to pay God a recompense in suffering. Remember, we've said how many times the essence of happiness is satisfied desires. The essence of pain is unsatisfied desires. What did we do when we sinned? We satisfied our desires contrary to the will of God. Very well. What does God do? You might say, he cannot help but do this. We having indulged our self-will in sinning, he must now sacrifice our self-will by enduring pain. Because what is pain? Pain is the experience of things we don't want. That's easy. Given all of those facts, our lives on earth, as we know, are short. And consequently, God will call most people before they have fully expiated the sins they've committed. Now, by expiation, I mean, especially, and the Church means, expiation of the pain or suffering due to sin. And before we go any further, let me just tell you, this is a precious, a priceless gift of our faith, to see pain as a price of sin. for ourselves. Things happen, as we casually and incorrectly say, we don't like. Whatever the nature of the pain may be. And I've told this to the Lord 1,000 times. But Lord, I've got it coming. This is my enlightened faith. We've got pain coming. In God, it is a mysterious providence, as we know, even has those who are innocent to suffer pain, to expiate for other sinners. But given the length of our lives, and I keep repeating the statement of St. Augustine, there's only one option we've got. We've got no choice about suffering. That is inevitable. The only question is, where are we going to suffer? Is it here or hereafter? Now, how can we help the poor souls? We can help the poor souls by everything that our faith tells us is an expiation for sin. In other words, there's really no limit. The basic 3 sources of grace from God are prayer, sacraments, and good works. All 3 are divinely ordained means of expiating the sins of those who are in purgatory, and thereby either shortening the time of their stay in purgatory or at least mitigating their suffering. Prayer. We know on faith again that, as we say in the Apostles' Creed, I believe in the communion of saints. Believing in the communion of saints means I believe that among the members of the church on her 3 levels of existence, the church militant on earth, suffering in purgatory, and triumphant in heaven, there was a constant exchange that in fact is the essence of the communion of saints. It is the constant interchange of merits and graces from one, shall we call it, division of the church with another. Those in heaven are constantly praying for us. Those in heaven are constantly doing good works. Unlike us, they can no longer sin. But God is pleased with what they're doing in heaven. And the more holy a person is, listen to this, the more holy a person is on earth for all eternity, the more blessings that person will obtain for other people, for all eternity. In other words, the more supernatural wealth we bring with us to heaven, the more, in God's mysterious providence, we shall be channels of grace to other people.
Father, can suffering on earth, physical suffering, say someone who has cancer or somebody who has Alzheimer's, can he offer that suffering up as well?
Oh, of course.
I always thought that.
In fact, this is why we've just begun to understand the responsibility that God is giving us in the pro-life movement. Take this madman, Kevorkian. Oh, but he's not alone. Behind him are two professions, the medical and legal professions. Mazuma. They want money. In other words, so far from shortening a person's life, as in the world's vocabulary, as being useless, my God, the more useless a life seems to be in the eyes of the world, the more useful is that life meant to be in the eyes of God, by both the one who suffers and, with emphasis, and those who are carrying or carrying. Both words count. The defective, the handicapped, the helpless.
Father, are you aware that in the Clinton health care bill, the provision for care for anyone over 70 is automatically terminated? Under the present plan, and I read it, I almost couldn't believe my eyes. I went to the library, it's in the Royal Library. At age 70, the Clinton health care bill does not pay for anything for anyone. And you cannot seek services by paying for it yourself.
The Lord is punishing America for its sins. We are living in the most devastating era of American history. When I read, as I have read, what you are sharing with us, having begun it, I think I told you, reading Marx from the age of 14, it is unqualified, simply demonic Marxism, Marx and Lenin. Children become wards of the state. Parents, if that bill goes through, the Russians who suffered for 70 years under communism will have had nothing on us. It is as though the Kremlin moved from Russia to the United States, and its present citadel is Washington, D.C., I know I'm being taped. Thanks.
Are we, you know, with this in mind, and it also, you know, in the bill, it funds abortion, and it's going to come out of Social Security payments and our taxes. Are we morally required then to support, I mean, this?
Once a people, like our country, once a people has abandoned, and this goes back, to the Anglo-Saxon world to the 16th century. Once the divinely established authority over the moral order is denied, that's the church founded by Christ. There is only one divinely established authority over the moral order in the world, and that is the Roman Catholic Church. Once you deny that authority, then what do? What they did in the 16th century transferred that authority from the church, founded by Christ, to the state. And what we're doing now, in one decision made by the two presidents of the United States. Once they decide, then that simple childlike faith that people should have towards legitimate authority is now being given, and nobody makes a whimper. And, and I couldn't say it, but I know I'm being taped. what I do say to the people who please God will do something about it. Our nation cannot survive on these premises. No way. Thank you. We are asking, therefore, how can we help the poor souls? And the answer is, in every way in which we can obtain from God what we call, in theological language, strange words, congruous merit before God. In other words, we have to merit from God. And of course, all that we've said about merit before, remember, we merit grace in the measure in which we ourselves are united with God. And indeed, as we at some length explained, the very difficulties in our lives are precisely a divinely ordained means of increasing what we call the voluntariety, the willpower that goes into our actions. And other things being equal, the harder something is, the more of our will we've got to do it, otherwise we wouldn't do it. Thank God, then, for the trials and the difficulties. And all I can tell you, I've been doing this, well, almost since my ordination. My mother died a year after my ordination to wake me up, to make me realize. I believed, of course, in purgatory, life after death, for my ordination. Once my mother died, I said to myself, oh, Harden, there's somebody in eternity whom you knew on earth. Because I told you, I never now see the grace after meals without adding, and may the souls of the faithful departed, through the mercy of God, rest in peace. Amen. First of all, I won't ask you, I'm sure, I won't even look, whether all of you are saying grace before and after meals. Say grace both before and after meals. May I ask you, today on the 7th of November, today the 7th, see, to promise the poor souls from my next meal on, when I say the grace after meals, I will add, and may the souls of the faithfully departed, through the mercy of God, rest in peace. Amen. And may the souls of the faithful departed, through the mercy of God, rest in peace. Amen. And be sure you come next time we have class. Next week, I'm going to ask for a raising of hands of how many of you, since last Sunday, that'll be next Sunday, have added the invocation for the poor souls. Okay? And the sacraments offering our masses, the masses that we assist at for the poor souls. And the church recommends that we be specific for whom we offer these masses. And having masses offered for the poor souls. Understandably, most of the masses over the years, say at Jesu here in Detroit, when I say the 6:30 Mass, with almost no exception, the masses are for some particular individual. Anna this or Joseph that. Their names, fine. But there's such a thing as offering masses for the poor souls. And without necessarily specifying, though the specification is also part of our faith, do not hesitate to specify. And it's not just, say, the sacrament of communion, remember, or the sacrament of the Mass, but the other sacraments, receiving the sacrament of confession, offering that for the poor souls. And then, of course, not only performing good works, but enduring, by doing God's will, no matter what the cost may be. I cannot tell you what a growth in the spiritual life you can develop if you cultivate the habit as much as possible of offering things in your life, especially the hard things, for the poor souls. This is real. Now, the implications. I have 9 implications. Let's go through what we've got here in our chart. We now have a body and a soul. There are 3 stages to our existence. There is never a merely bodily state. There was never a merely soul state before we conceived. Unlike the Mormons, as I'm sure you know, as Joseph Smith conceived the revelation he thought he got, that there are just millions and millions of souls waiting for bodies to enter. The poor souls. That was his justification for polygamy. So let's have is, well, a man has many wives as you can find. And of course, there was even a distinction. If you're a prophet like Joseph Smith, you could have more. In any case, the purpose, according to Joseph Smith, was there were so many souls, helpless, waiting to be embodied. And by conceiving a child, you provide the body for a lonely soul that wants to be incarnated. Well, that's not our faith. At the same moment that our body, remember this, the moment our parents provided our bodies, at that moment God created an immortal soul. Stage number 1, body and soul. Second stage, soul alone. And the body was left of it. It doesn't take too long for the body to decay. This, by the way, as for example, when I was in California about a month ago on business, just happened to look at the paper. I got my midnight snack, and there was a cosmetologist, a quarter page ad in the paper, and for different, cosmetic tasks that are performed by this cosmetic surgeon. For example, wrinkles, I know, they cost $8,500 to remove from your face. $8,500.
My face.
There's no guarantee that the wrinkles won't return. Just list the price. All the different things have begun. Can be done to beautify the body. God, it becomes just, I mean, that's really the comic page. If you have the faith, maybe. And the billions of dollars that are being spent on a body that within days of being buried will be unbearable. You know, that converted the great Saint Francis, not Francis of Assisi, but Francis Borgia. Remember the Borgia family? Oh, they left a bad reputation behind them. Well, Francis was a good man. His wife died. And then he became, as we know, a Jesuit in secret, so nobody would know it, until his children grew up and could be taken care of by themselves. But was converted Francis Borgia. Was the opening of the coffin of the Queen, a beautiful woman. It was just some months after her burial. And he became a changed man. And then the third stage is the soul reunited with the body. And this too, the whole world now that has any faith is preoccupied with a massive homicide, genocide taking place in, I would have to say, in every country now. Though not every country has yet legalized abortion. But just about. What we've got to keep reminding ourselves of is that we have both a body and a soul. And the soul not only can but does exist without the body. Which, by the way, is not clear anywhere in classic historic Protestantism. That's their problem. And teaching my dear Protestants, now, the Lutheran School of Theology, or the Bethany School of Theology, or the Siberian Western School of Theology, I told them, what you need to do is recover your faith in the fact that we have a body and a soul, and that when the body dies, the soul remains alive. The human race, therefore, is in four states. I have three. On earth, in purgatory, and in heaven. Question. What should I have put in?
Hell.
Please?
Hell.
Well, I wanted to keep hell out of it. So, do your notes have human race in four states of union with God?
Oh, not with God.
What should I have done? Change the four to what?
Three.
To three. In the Lord, you can't imagine the mistakes I make. Most of the words I don't talk about. Some of that people don't notice or realize. But every once in a while, the Lord wants to make sure what my, remember, novice master told me? John, you are an intellectual bully. Or Sister Gorgonia in the fifth grade, remember? Johnny, stop showing off. So this helps. So if you leave what's there, human race, in three states of union with God. And the moment we say in union with God, and oh, how this needs to be said, that means we are in loving union with others. Nobody is in loving union with anybody unless that person is united with God. You know that we've said before in our previous lecture, applies here, and that is why by now several thousand married people that I've told, what you two most need is each of you, well, get closer to God, commit fewer sins, go to confession more often, pray more, anything to draw you as an individual closer to God, then you'll be more at peace with each other. No one can be at peace with anyone unless he is first in peace with God. No one, no one. And that is why over the years, persons have caused me traumatic pain. It took years to cultivate this. My response now is deep pity, sympathy. People who are, say, offensive, unkind, cruel, unjust, you name the adjective, towards others, there are no exceptions. They are all in that same degree not united with God. Now the solidarity in the mystical body. The term, by the way, solidarity, as you know, is one of the favorite terms of our present Holy Father. And the term, by the way, recurs many times in the forthcoming catechism. It's a term that American or modern society understands, a solidarity. But notice, the most fundamental solidarity between or among human beings is a solidarity that is based on either union with God by faith or union with God by vision. So it's not just that love of God unites people between or among one another. It is also for us on earth and the souls in purgatory, our faith in God. The souls in purgatory do not see God face to face. They are still living by faith. And their hope is assured that they will reach heaven. In that sense, they are like us. And that is why, unless two people really share the same faith, well, they can, well, form a company. They can even cooperate in some business. But when it comes to helping one another, which is what we're talking about here for the poor souls, we've got to believe that there is retribution for sin, and that therefore there are persons suffering, and we want to help them. Those in heaven, of course, they know. They are praying for us. They are also praying for the poor souls in purgatory. And the poor souls are also praying for us.